Good to have you all here tonight. Dr. Gary Habermas is the distinguished chair of the Department of Theology and Philosophy at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. In November of 2006, I was at the National Apologetics Conference and got to hear Dr. Habermas along with Ravi Zacharias and Lee Strobel and some of the other top apologists in the world. And I just said, Dr. Habermas, do you ever come and do like a church setting? He said, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. And I said, well, we'd love to have you, and we tried to work it out, and we found out he was willing to do that. I talked to Kevin and asked him if he would be willing to invite him here to FCA, and he did that. And so this is kind of the culmination of that, of quite a long time of planning, and we're glad that you're here tonight. Dr. Habermas has authored about 29 books. He speaks at university campuses. I think he's done 1,600 of these type lectures at over 100 universities, such as Duke, North Carolina, Virginia, Notre Dame, Arizona, Arizona State. He's spoken all over the world. In fact, when he leaves here, he goes back home and is then going to Cal Poly and then on to England, where he'll be speaking at Oxford and Cambridge and then at Edinburgh in Scotland. So we're just delighted to have him. We're glad that you're here tonight. We want to welcome all of you and hope you'll give Dr. Habermas a warm welcome. There are some of his books out there on the book table. And then there also is a website, www.GaryHabermas.com, where you can get free downloads of his material, not just on the resurrection, that is his chief expertise, but some other material, like on doubt. And I encourage you to go there. And we're just delighted to have him, and he's going to come and share the evidence for the resurrection.
Good evening. I've really enjoyed this. I'm a late night guy. I can handle this. But I'm glad to be with you here at Clemson. I love speaking on other campuses. And it's good to see what's going on down here. Let me tell you a little bit of something about myself real briefly. I was raised in a Christian home, but I went through a long period of doubt. And I'll tell you more about that later. But I came very close to walking away from Christianity. In fact, at one point I thought I had. And I ended up doing my doctorate dissertation, my PhD, at Michigan State. I told the group last night, whenever I go somewhere at a State University campus, I have to stop and think, where am I? Because, you know, Clemson, Michigan State, they don't hate each other too much. But if I go into Minnesota, where I used to teach, you know, there'd be problems. And you don't want to go to the University of Michigan when you've been from Michigan State. So you know how those things go. Clemson's nice neutral territory, and it's a great academic school. Glad to be with you. But it was in Michigan State where I was going through this, and I wrote my dissertation on the resurrection. And it kind of brought me back front and center. Now, what I'd like to share with you is an argument that occurred to me then, because it's an argument that does not presuppose the truth of Christianity. It doesn't say the resurrection happened because the Bible said it happened. Now, I think you can make that move, but I think you have to do some homework. But I'm going to take a different approach tonight. It's what I call the minimal facts argument. It's explained on my website. Nothing's for sale on my website. Anything you find, use, look at, videos, debates. In fact, last time I spoke at ACC school, it was Duke Divinity School, and I had a debate with the professor there. It's online. So you can hopefully find some of that, and you can find a lot more than I'm talking about tonight. But here's the approach I would use. If there's anybody here who's a skeptic or an unbeliever, and your Christian friends talk to you, maybe they even got you to come tonight, and you might use a very insightful question about Christianity. And it goes something like this. Skeptic speaking to his or her Christian friend. You want me to believe the man? Yep, I'd like that. The man's in the book. Yep. Well, sorry, I don't believe the book, so I don't believe the man. Now, as a Christian, you might just rehearse in your mind, what would you say to somebody who said, I don't believe the book, therefore I don't believe the man? I think some Christians would stumble on this one. I think a fair amount would. Now, those who are close used to reading Christian apologetics, which is the area, the word apologetics has nothing to do with apologizing. It has to do everything with defending the faith. That's what the word means in the Greek. It's a New Testament term. And so you might start saying, well, I think the New Testament's a pretty reliable book. But the method I'm going to use tonight is called the minimal facts argument. It has two prerequisites. two steps. I'll do the second one first. I'm only, well, I won't say only, but I'm going to use almost totally data tonight that are conceded by the skeptical community. How skeptical? Well, they'd be conceded by the Jesus Seminar. Now, you know, many of you know that group. They're the group that, according to their colored beads that they threw into a hat, they rejected between 80 and 90% of the red letter words of Jesus. Pretty skeptical. And they would concede this data tonight once I start talking about Paul. So here's the approach I'm going to take. I'm going to say, my argument's going to be something like this. If the Bible's inspired, Jesus raised the dead. If the Bible's not inspired, but it's reliable, Jesus raised from the dead. I'll mention those, but here's the part for tonight. If the Bible's neither inspired nor reliable, and it's only a book of ancient literature, Jesus is still raised from the dead. So, on the resurrection of Jesus, which is the center of faith, everything we have is based on it, as Christians, it's a heads I win, tails you lose argument. The Bible's the Word of God, Jesus is raised from the dead, Christian is true. If the Bible's not the Word of God, it's just a book of ancient history, Jesus is still raised from the dead, the center of faith is still true. In fact, this is a joke, but I tell students, you know how you know the Bible's at least a book of ancient literature? You know what's required for something to be a book of ancient literature? It's got to be really, really old. It's got to be written down in pages. Preferably, it's bound. That's all it's required. It's an old book, right? So is Shakespeare, so is Homer. And we can tell some things from those books, too. But I'm going to use the critics' facts and say we have enough to show Jesus was raised. If you know more than what the critics know, if you accept more than what the critics accept, you have even more reasons to accept the resurrection. Now, to go back to my original question, I'm going to say something real, real fast. The average Christian is going to respond to that man and book question like this. Well, have you read the Gospels? Oh, I forgot to tell you. Step one. Step one of my timeline, which I'm going to be marking off tonight, that's B.C., that's 2008. This is 30 A.D. We don't know the exact year. We're going to be marking off plus and minus from this, so it's irrelevant what the exact date is. But Jesus died approximately 30 A.D., give or take. And the average Christian response is going to be something like this. Have you read the book of Mark? It's a pretty good source. It's only about 35 or 40 years after the cross. Now, I'm going to use critics' dating now, not conservatives. And they'll even say, Matthew's about 10 years later. Luke's about 5 years later. And everyone puts John about 65 years later or 95 AD. You got to subtract 30 because that's ground zero. So about 65 AD. And the critics are going to say, believers are going to say, we've got some good reasons for believing these four books. Hence, good reason for believing the resurrection. And this argument works. Just to be real careful with it. I'm going to use a totally different argument tonight. I'm going to say, let's use the writings of Paul. Paul is the critic's darling, but you got to play the game the way the critics play it if you want to use their data. Of the 13 books that bear Paul's name, they only give you, they grant about half of them. And those half, nobody dispute. But you know what? The ones they grant are the ones that most Christians most want to use. They're going to grant the following sources as being authoritative. Always Romans. Always 1 Corinthians, always 2 Corinthians, always Galatians, always Philippians, always those, always 1 Thessalonians, Philemon. But those first six are big theological books. Romans, 1 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians. They accept those books. I only want to use a few verses tonight, 1 Corinthians 15. And a few verses that come at the end of Galatians 1 and go into Galatians 2. There was no chapter division in the original. So a few verses in Galatians, a few verses 1 Corinthians 15. I do not know a single scholar who will deny Pauline authorship or who will deny authenticity of those books. They're in with critics. Now, ground zero, Jesus died. Christians believe he was raised from the dead. Paul writes about this just 25 years later, or 55 A.D., in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 and 2, he says, I presented the gospel to you. And if you believe that gospel, you're Christian. And if not, you're not. Let me talk about that real briefly. Whenever the gospel is defined in the New Testament, it's chiefly in the epistles of Paul and the book of Acts. But whenever the the gospel is defined, these three are always present. Jesus is Son of God. He's deity. Or some other term for deity besides Son of God. He's Lord. Something like that. He died. He's raised again from the dead. Deity, death, resurrection of Jesus. And then, those are three things Jesus is and did, according to the New Testament. And there's one more thing, Paul says. Do you believe? Now, Christians make a big deal of this word believe. Well, let me say something about it. The Greek word is pistuo. And it's a very strong word. It doesn't mean, do you believe George Washington is the first president of the United States? Or, I do believe vanilla is the best brand of ice cream. That's not what believe means. In the New Testament, believe means to believe deeply and single-mindedly. It means to trust. It means to surrender to. It means to cast yourself upon. In fact, you're probably familiar with a lot of verses in the New Testament that say, believe in the name of, pistuo eis, believe in, or believe in the name of. When believe in is there, or believe in the name of, it's even stronger. Because in that part of the world at that time, in the name of, a person's name represented who they were in their essence. And to believe in the name of Jesus is to believe him wholeheartedly. I think the closest analogy we have to it in English is, I do. Remember? I do. What do we say? Richer for poor, sickness and health, till death do we part. That's basically what we say to Christ. So, death, burial, resurrection, combined with I do, equals salvation. That's Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 and 2. Then he says this in verse 3. When I came to you, and by the way, he preached this at 55 AD, he came to them about 4 years earlier, about 51. So already back 4 years. He says, 1 Corinthians 15:3, when I came to you, I delivered unto you material that I also received. Most people in the 20th century wouldn't think it's a very heavy comment. I gave you something I received. Okay, Paul, get on with it. But those words have occupied a generation of critical scholars. Because Paul is using technical words for passing on tradition. Let's remember, he was a Pharisee. He was an expert in Old Testament, basically PhD in the Old Testament. He was the sharpest. He says, in his own words, I was ahead of my age in my scholarship. And don't say, well, quit bragging, because he goes on to say, it was all for nothing. Sharp guy, good scholar, and he uses the technical words for passing on tradition, delivered and received. From whom did he get this stuff? And when? Because, see, when you're studying historiography, even modern historiography, it's a lot harder to get in ancient history. But the two most important things to get in a study of historiography are these two. You want early eyewitness testimonies. Now, early eyewitness testimony can be wrong, could be, but it's the best historical data we have. Early eyewitness testimony. And I was saying earlier, if you want to say, well, John, it's just plus 65. I mean, that's not the end of the world. Could have been with Jesus. In fact, a recent book just came out, Richard Baucom, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, argues John is written by an eyewitness. Matthew, Luke, only plus 55. Mark, plus 35 or 40. You know what the best known life of Alexander the Great? It's called The Life of Alexander, written by Plutarch, is plus 400 years. You say, well, I bet you're getting ready to talk about the resurrection, aren't you? Yep. What do you think about Buddha's miracles? You know that Buddha's miracles? It's very difficult because you can't really date the sources, but this much they know. The sources that record Buddha's miracles are between 300 and 500 years after Buddha lived. Would you believe some account of Vietnam if the earliest report were between 300 and 500 years after Vietnam? Might be some fact there. The problem is, you can't tell. So we want early eyewitness testimony. So when Paul's saying this in 55, he says, I gave you what I was given. Oh, it's earlier than that. Yeah. From whom did you get it? Now, the next part of the argument is not, it didn't come from conservatives. In fact, conservatives didn't catch on for about 20 years. Critics gave this part of the argument. They said, let me give you the conclusion first. Paul received this material in Jerusalem 35 to 36 AD, about 5 years after the cross, maybe six, about 5 years after the cross, when in the book of Galatians, chapter 1, verse 18, Paul says, I went up to Jerusalem, And he said, I met the apostles there, Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. Now, this is really, really early. And you say, how do you know it's 35 AD? Paul does the math for us, and critics take Paul at his word. I mean, that's just the state of scholarship today. I can tell you why, but that would take a long time. I mean, I'll be glad to talk with you afterwards for a few minutes. Here's the cross. Critical scholars think that Paul came to Jesus, and the following sentence, every critic, I am not aware of a critic who won't agree with the sentence. Paul had experiences, real experiences, that he believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. Nobody disputes that. And when are they dated? About plus two. Some say plus one, some say plus three. Average, about plus two. Then Paul says in Galatians 1:18, 3 years later, I went to Jerusalem. Very simple, two plus three. He might be off by a few months. Might be as much as a year. But he went to Jerusalem 5 to 6 years after the cross. Okay, one thing's for sure. This is early. Early. And we're going to get earlier still. But that's early. And Paul talked to two other eyewitnesses, Peter and James. Critics will not disagree with the following statement. Peter and James had real experiences which they believe were appearances of the risen Jesus. Won't argue with you. So I got Paul, Peter, James, three skeptics. By the way, according to our earliest sources, all three of them were martyrs for their faith. We have first century sources saying all three died as martyrs. Paul, Peter, James, the brother of Jesus. This is James, the brother of Jesus, not the son of Zebedee. And that's interesting because James, the brother of Jesus, was an unbeliever until he met Jesus. So Paul says, I met with him. What was he doing? Well, Paul helps us because he uses a Greek word in this verse, Galatians 1:18, hystereisai. The root word, you probably can already guess what it is. The root word is histor. It is the Greek word from which we get our word history. And in the first century, it was used of those who perform a first-hand investigation. Histor is what someone does when they go and they check something out. And they're an eyewitness. Well, that's good. So it goes down here. Paul comes here. He's with them here. He's got the three best known Christians at that time, Peter, James, Paul. He's playing the investigative reporter. And what's he talking about? Well, the first rule of literary criticism, the rule that you hope your professors grade your papers with, is judge you according to your standards. You should always tell your professors, they probably told you. Tell them in the first couple paragraphs what you intend to do and what you don't intend to do. And within reason, the professor generally will grade according to the job you set out for yourself and how well you pull off this research. That's what Paul's doing. He's telling you his research. I went to Jerusalem, I met with Peter and James, and I'm going to do some first-hand research. On what subject? What's that rule of literary criticism? You always interpret a text in its context. Always interpret a text in its context. In Galatians chapter 1, Paul says the discussion before and after is on the topic of the resurrection of Jesus. Sorry, it's on the topic of the gospel, of which the resurrection, he tells you very clearly, is an indispensable part. Deity, death, resurrection of Jesus. If that's not enough, just 5 years afterwards, in Galatians chapter 2, just a few verses later, because Galatians 1 ends right here, then Galatians 2 starts, and Paul says, 14 years later, I went back up to Jerusalem. And this time I met with Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, and John. What would you have paid for a ticket to drive a little distance and see Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, John, and Paul speak? Or here's another one. Could you tell me a Christian you'd rather hear from? They're only the four biggest names in the ancient world, the four names most responsible for spreading the gospel. They're here together. And one, I mean, they have to be on my list of the most five most incredible verses of the New Testament. It might be number one. It's Galatians 2:2. Paul says, I set before them the gospel I preached to see if I was running or had run in vain. What? I set before them the gospel I preached to see if I was running or had run in vain. Yeah, I got you the first time, but did I hear you right? You said after 14 years of preaching, you set before the other apostles the gospel you were preaching to make sure you weren't making mistakes? I think Paul would say, you haven't been following my argument. I told you I got it from Jesus himself about plus two. I went up to Jerusalem just plus three, five total, for some first-hand research, histor. This is my third trip. It could be his fourth, depending on what you do with Acts chapter 15, but that's not the subject. My third trip, minimum, to Jerusalem, to see those who were scholars before me, Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, John, and of course Paul himself. Barnabas and Titus are also there. I've already checked it out with Jesus and then with them. I just want to make sure I'm still on track. Was he running in vain? Galatians chapter 2, verse 6. They added nothing to me. They added nothing to me.